Right, and we're going to first have an organizational meeting, which I'd like to open. But I also like to open with a little bit of a welcome to everybody and a thanks for your willingness to come and participate in what could be an intellectually challenging and politically challenging subject. But you brought some great expertise to the room. I'm really pleased to have everyone here. I want to make sure folks know who is staffing us and appreciate what they do, which I do very much. Erin Seiler is our committee administrator. We will generally have Zoe Larmer as our committee assistant, but today Jessica Wengler is doing that job. From the Secretary of State's office, Elections Division, Alana Cox is here, so she'll be helping me with the kind of Elections Division response. And Lord Terrell is here in the room today. She may be in and out, just she kind of follows me around and make sure I'm paying attention to business. So I wanted to make sure that everybody knew those familiar faces as we get started with our work. In today's meeting, as you saw from the agenda, we've opened here with an organizational meeting. We'll then move to an informational meeting, and Dan Gilbert, Deputy Legislative Counsel, is here and will provide us some information and get some discussion, I'm sure, and questions started for us in that. We'll then move to a discussion of the task force objectives, work plans, and goals. I'm going to ask you to bear with me and do a little bit of brainstorming on a couple of different areas. Most of you I've had some chance to have a little conversation with, and I'm not going to make you trust me to put your thoughts on the table. This will be a chance to kind of get some of that out for the committee to work with. We had planned always to have in each of these meetings a public comment period. So if there are folks here who aren't on the task force but are from the general public and would like to say something to us, we'll always have a 15 to 20 minute period at the end of the meetings where people can do that. So I'm not sure if we have an agenda that will get us all the way to 1 o'clock, which you might be grateful for when you get hungry for lunch, but depends on how lively our discussion is. And I will try to take a 15-minute break in the middle here so people can check cell phones and run downstairs if they're out of caffeine or whatever they need to do. So that's just my little overall welcome to you all. Our first task is to, under the organizational meeting, is to adopt the task force rules. You should have received them and they should be in front of you. They're a fairly simple set of rules. And Erin, do you want to go through them for folks so they don't have to just listen to my voice?
Madam Chair, members of the task force, the rules are pretty standard task force rules that are used during the interim session, as this is not a very clean legislative committee, so it's not all members. It's not a joint committee, so we have kind of standard rules regarding meeting times, designation of committee hearings, when the amendment of rules can be done by this committee. So should they choose, we can amend our rules. It just clearly states that no seconds are required on motions. Chair can assign committee to receive testimony. Should we not have a quorum, you can always have an informational under less of a quorum. The chair sets in and calls meetings to orders. The meeting will comply with public meeting laws. We like to give as much notice as possible whenever we have a committee meeting in terms of an agenda, but we will definitely give no fewer than 48 hours for a committee hearing. Should we come to a point in taking action, we can request a roll call vote, and it requires a majority of the committee members appointed to approve any action, as this is not a legislative committee entirely, so it requires a quorum of this committee versus having a quorum of each chamber. And so very straightforward. And if you are on other task forces this interim, you will see a similar set of rules adopted.
So I'm going to move to adopt the proposed task force rules, but want to see if there's any discussion.
I have a question. Will we be given information about what we need to know regarding open meetings laws?
We certainly can provide that for you, absolutely.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps you can have a specific request to
notice today, all these meetings will be in hearing rooms that are going to be televised on the internet through our Granica system. They are all recorded. They are all open to the public. So that's the kind of the crux of our meeting laws in terms of notification. The legislative chamber sets specific deadlines for posting agendas. It's a little bit more discretionary for public meeting laws, but as a practice, we try to give as much notice as possible. I like no more than 48 hours because that meets minimum standards for both the House and the Senate chambers, but we will always give more whenever possible, but primarily always open to the public. They are televised, they are being live streamed, they are being recorded for review.
And I said that may not be part of the rules, but it is our intent to set aside some portion of the meeting agenda each time for any public comment that people want to bring forward. Thank you, Mr. Market. Good question. And you might note that generally speaking, if their chair has not been named by the statute, there is a process for electing a chair. In this case, the statute kindly gave me that responsibility. Anyway, that's the other last piece of the rule. So any other discussion? Any objections? If not, the motion passes and the rules are adopted. Thank you. So our second task under the organizational meeting is to have folks make some kind of introduction of themselves. If you could provide your name and the role you're fulfilling, because we did have sort of categories of people that we were to appoint and to be appointed, including the legislators in the task force. I don't mind if you've got the 1 minute elevator, what you bring to the table, but we will be having a chance for a lot of brainstorming later, so don't feel the need to get all your thoughts out at this at this particular moment, but like to go around the room and make sure that we've introduced ourselves, and perhaps we should start on the phone. Aaron's nodding. I already know something that I'm supposed to do. So I know for sure we have Representative Gilliam on the phone. Introduce yourself.
I'm Representative Gilliam.
Well, already a little bit of the smart out. We understand that. Do want to note that we're very lucky that our legislative members are all members of the Rules Committee of both the House and the Senate. You might have noted in our statute that when we do a report at the end of this year, it's to the two Rules Committees. So these folks will have heard a lot of our discussion and hopefully also participated and helped us understand how they see it. So thank you for the legislators who are involved. Also on the phone, we have Trent Lutz. Trent, are you there?
Yes, this is Trent Lutz, representing the Democratic Party of Oregon. I served as the executive director of the Democratic Party of Oregon for about 6.5 years, and am back to help represent them on this task force. I've been involved in election issues for the last 17 years in one way, shape, or form, and excited to be a part of this conversation.
Wonderful. And then for introduction, to start on my left here.
Sure. So I'm Diane Rosenbaum. I am a state senator, and I chair the Senate Committee on Rules and Executive Appointments. I've got a strong interest in the area of campaign finance reform, and this was the only task force I requested to serve on in the interim. The committee that I chair and that Senator Boqvist is on heard a couple of pieces of legislation this past session, SJR-5, which was the referral for a constitutional amendment to amend the Oregon Constitution to allow us to do anything effectively in this area. So, and a bit of ancient history for me before, I guess I was in the legislature, but back in the year 2000, I served on the steering committee of an initiative campaign that went to the ballot to create a public funding system in Oregon for campaigns that didn't unfortunately meet with success with voters, but I have had a strong interest in campaign finance reform for a long time.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Dave Rosenfeld. I am representing one of the two folks here, along with Dave Ellis, representing non-affiliated voters. I live in Portland with my wife and two kids, and most of my perspective on the issue of campaign finance reform is probably shaped by, for most of my adult life, I've worked in one way, shape, or form for public interest research groups, PIRGs, which are nonpartisan public interest groups. Most recently, I'm the executive director of OSPIRG, which is the organization here in Oregon. And so a lot of my perspective is shaped by the work that those groups have done in Oregon for a long time, including probably as far back as 1994, when OSPIRG was one of the lead groups working to pass Measure 9, which I think we'll be talking about a little bit later on. And happy to be here and grateful to have the chance to work with you all and discuss this really important issue.
I'm Norman Turrell. I'm representing the League of Women Voters, and I'm also the state president of the League of Women Voters now. I have actually quite a depth of experience with campaign finance laws going back some 30 or 40 years. Actually started in the 1970s sometime when I was working with the Common Cause organization, and during the 1990s I helped draft a initiative petition for the state of Washington, Initiative 582, as I recall, and that gathered 122,000 signatures for the ballot, but we needed more like 150, and so we failed. But that was a maybe defining experience in trying to limit campaign contributions and provide for public funding. The League has a definite interest in this area. We have a depth of knowledge going back decades and a position that I'll have to follow as a representative of the organization. And hopefully I can provide a lot of background and depth of experience for the task force.
Congratulations on your election as their new president.
Thank you.
Was not very long ago that happened.
Remains to be seen how that works
out.
Yes,
right. I know the feeling. Mr. Woolley.
So I'm Seth Woolley. I'm representing the Pacific Green Party and the Progressive Party. I'm currently on the state coordinating committee of the Pacific Green Party and was twice their nominated Secretary of State candidate in 2008 and 2012. And I've talked a lot about campaign finance reform issues in the campaigns, and that's my summary. I'm a software engineer and with spatial databases. That's my main job.
I'm Kyle Markley. I'm the nominee from the Libertarian Party of Oregon. My role here is going to be the voice of skepticism, the one who says that freedom matters and privacy matters. I have twice been a candidate for public office. I have complied with campaign finance laws. I have seen the barrier to entry that they create for people who don't have large organizational backing. So that's the perspective I'm bringing.
My name is Daniel Lukow, and I work for Common Cause Oregon. We're a national organization that's nonpartisan, and we advocate for campaign finance reform, both on a federal level and on a state level. We're very excited about this task force. We're really excited to work for some good campaign finance reform solutions for the 2016 legislative short session and maybe even for the 2017 regular long session. We're here to provide a course for, we're here to represent nonprofits that advocate for campaign finance reform. And we have a team of legal and policy experts in D.C. that can also provide any kind of access to information, resources, expertise that might be helpful for this committee, too.
My name is Misan Kwan, and I am the current Washington County Organizing Director for CIO, the Center for Intercultural Organizing. CIO has done a lot of work trying to seeking to engage underrepresented or underengaged communities, particularly communities of color, immigrant and refugee community members. And so I'm the role I'm fulfilling is the nonprofit community-based organization. We are also, a CBO advocacy group. And then I'd say also just, personally, I'm very interested in campaign finance. I've done research academically and professionally into campaign finance analysis, but I think we're really excited for the opportunity to be here representing the community-based organizations, and particularly our engagement with, civic engagement and leadership development within these communities in Oregon.
I'm Rob Harris. I'm the nominee for the Independent Party of Oregon. I'm an attorney from Hillsboro. I have a law firm out there. I give money to Osberg, and I am a member of the Hillsboro Chamber of Commerce. I was a prosecutor. I've done criminal defense work, indigent defense work. In the meantime, over 30 years worth of practicing law in Hillsboro, mainly in Hillsboro, also a big law firm, as well as a prosecutor now in my own practice. We're based in Hillsboro, volunteer in the Independent Party. I guess I'm a nominating caucus. I'm not sure that's an official office, but I am their nominee. And I'm really hopeful to work with all of you and just set up a framework or to make whatever progress we can to improve the democracy we have.
My name is Nikki Fisher. I'm the executive director of the Bus Project. The Bus Project is an organization that gets young people excited to participate in democracy. We feel like our members are really excited about trying to engage further.
Nikki, and then we'll talk to the person on the phone.
Yep, that's perfect. I'm wrapped it up, though.
Okay. Wonderful. So that was either Trent hanging up or as he came in the room or somebody else. Did somebody else join us on the phone? Nope. Okay. Very good. Thank you.
I'm Dave Ellis. I should make a note as a profession. I'm an archaeologist, and my life is just like Indiana Jones. I will promise not to bring my whip to any future meetings. I have, a few years ago, was a co-founder like Dave. I'm a representative here today as for non-affiliated voters. I got involved. I've been involved in this for a number of years of representing independent voters with a small I. Even though I was a registered Democrat until a few years ago, and I was co-founder a couple years ago with for Independent Voters of Oregon, with the idea of as we're independent, getting a consensus on things can be a challenge, as you can imagine. But I think the one area of agreement is moving forward to making the political system more open, more transparent. And I would say that's the sort of priority we're bringing to the task force.
Thank you. Excuse me, Dustin, let's check it. Senator Boquist, is that you or someone else has joined us on the phone? Representative Gillum, are you still there? We may have lost him, so we'll just have people cycle in and out as we do.
I'm Justin Delaney. I believe I was nominated by the Oregon Business Council and Oregon Business Association, largely without my consent. I have participated in campaign finance reform work groups multiple times with Governor Brown, then Secretary. And have a lot of history from Dan Meek's efforts in the past. I can't say I always agreed with those, but I have some background there. And Daniel's predecessor at Common Cause, Janice, was on that committee. My day job, I work for Standard Insurance Company, The Standard. We're 107 or 8-year-old Portland-based insurance company. I'm an attorney, and I oversee pretty much everything external at the Standard, the corporate legal and charitable giving and PR. I'm just really excited to be here. I will share Kyle's skepticism on most proposals because this is one of those topics. It's like whack-a-mole. You do one thing and independent expenditures pop up over here. So I'm open but skeptical, I would say.
My name is Dan Rayfield. I'm an attorney, state representative for Corvallis, and I was just in a mediation with the Standard Insurance Company yesterday, one of your officers. So,
and Representative Rehfeld is well on the House Rules Committee. I want to note the absence of our representative from the Republican Party of Oregon. They still could show up any minute. Margie Hughes, who is a relatively new. Renewed, I think, ex-executive director for them, was selected to be a member of the task force. I know that she had a scheduling issue that came up relatively late and hoped that she and or the chair could be here. If one of them isn't able to come today, we'll be sure and reach out, and particularly around the brainstorming subjects, try to make sure that we've got their concerns reflected in the discussion as we go forward. So, and let me finally introduce myself. I'm Jean Atkins. Last March, I was appointed to be Secretary of State to fill out the remainder of Secretary Brown's term when she became governor. I have a long history inside and out of this building of doing state program management and work with state legislative leadership offices. And in the last 5 years before I unsuccessfully retired, I was state director for Senator Jeff Merkley, managing the 19 Senate staff that work here in Oregon. I would just offer one of the things that I bring to this. I may have said this to several of you as I talked on the phone, but one of the good experiences of that last 5 years was a town hall in every county every year, and so opportunity 36 times five to kind of hear from folks who come to town halls, which are somewhat self-selected and understood. But one of the things that struck me very, very strongly is that in every meeting, almost every place, whether the issue topic was brought up directly or not brought up directly, people's concern about money and politics and their cynicism about that and their frustration that despite that feeling, change had not come, was palpable. Just a very stark reminder to me that there's a public perception issue that is there. And pleased to have the chance, if there's only 3 yards down the field we move this, so be it, but to at least have the opportunity to work with the group to see if there's something that we can do that feels right and also addresses that. So I bring to you that as my only bias. I'm sure I have others, not all of them. So, okay, well, thank you very much for all of that. And let's open our informational meeting. We're going to get an overview of current campaign finance system at the federal and state level by Dan Gilbert, our deputy legislative counsel. Many of you have delved into this law area over a number of years, and Dan, I think, is aware of that and understands he's talking. But what I hoped was that this would give us an opportunity to have a little baseline of information that we all kind of operate from before we start talking about reform or change ideas. And I'm sure he's going to be open to questions. Maybe we'll let him give us a little bit of an overview first, and then. I'm sure he will welcome both questions and people's additional insights that they may want to offer on that subject. So thank you, Dan.
Absolutely.
Take it away.
All right. Chair Atkins, members of the task force, for the record, my name is Dan Gilbert, the deputy legislative counsel here. Asked to come here today and give a very brief overview or introduction to the federal and state campaign finance laws. With somewhat of an emphasis on the issues with contribution limits. Before I really get into it, I just wanted to make a broader point, which is that there is a good amount of legal uncertainty with several things that people may want to do. That's particularly true in Oregon, as I'll get into. As a result, there are things that people may want to do, that this task force may want to do, that it just would be uncertain how a court would determine them. It's not necessarily a reason not to do it or to do it, but it's just something to be aware of.
The basic rule is that in order for something, for a law to be constitutional, it needs to comply with both the U.S. and Oregon constitutions. Campaign finance, that primarily means that it needs to comply with these free speech guarantees in Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution and the First Amendment. There have been a lot of First Amendment cases that have been held. There is still some uncertainty and some shifting ground in the federal law. There have been far fewer Article 1, Section 8 cases, especially in the field of campaign finance. That is particularly problematic just because we know from Oregon courts that Article 1, Section 8 offers more freedom of speech than the First Amendment. So it is more restrictive. The exactly where that line is still somewhat case dependent. And Oregon courts have been clear that they will first determine whether something complies with Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, and only if it does will they look to see whether it complies with the First Amendment. So, you know, just in terms of basic structure, you have political committees, which are two or more individuals or a person other than individual, like a corporation, that have received contributions for the purpose of supporting or opposing a candidate, measure, or political party, or that have made an expenditure other than an independent expenditure for the purpose of supporting or opposing a candidate, measure, or political party. Contributions in general are monies that are given to political entities like a candidate or a political committee, generally for the purpose of influencing an election. Expenditures are generally monies that are spent in support of or in opposition to a candidate, political committee, or measure. They include contributions made by a candidate or political committee to another candidate or political committee. Then you have independent expenditures, which are monies that are spent in support of or in opposition to a candidate or measure, but are not made with the cooperation, prior consent, or in any consultation with the candidate, the political committee, or an agent. You know, in general, the contributions, expenditures, independent expenditures, they're all forms of speech. The U.S. Supreme Court, in general, has historically held that avoiding corruption or the appearance of corruption is pretty much the is a sufficient reason, but pretty much the only sufficient reason to limit that kind of speech. It has historically permitted reasonable contribution limits, and there are federal contribution limits that are set out for federal candidates. It is very hard to limit expenditures, and it is not possible to limit contributions to super PACs, which are entities that only they're independent expenditure only committees. The difficulty in limiting expenditures also means that there is really no and their basis for why you can limit it means that it is it would be hard to come up with a justification for why you could limit the amount of money that would be given to, for example, a ballot measure. It is there's no real corruption or appearance of corruption at issue with the ballot measure the way there is for candidates. So, you know, how does this really play out? I spoke with the secretary, and one of the things she suggested was possibly just talking briefly about two bills that came before the Senate Rules Committee this year. First, you had Senate Joint Resolution 5. So campaign contribution limits. Again, first we look to Oregon law, and current Oregon law is clear. The Supreme Court has said that under Article 1, Section 8, you cannot limit contributions. It is a violation of free speech. So if we want to limit contributions, what would have to happen first is there would need to be a constitutional amendment. So an example of that was done, can be seen, Senate Joint Resolution 5 from this past 2015 session. It seeks to amend the Oregon Constitution to allow the Legislative Assembly or the people through the initiative process to enact laws limiting or prohibiting contributions made in connection with campaigns for nomination or election to public office. So if That would be a very broad constitutional permission, which would mean that for campaigns for nomination or election to public office, the Oregon Constitution would essentially be permissive, and the limits that would be placed on it would be the federal limits. Based on what happened with various ballot measures in 2007, there is currently a ballot measure 47, which the Supreme Court has said will go into effect if and establishes various contribution limits that the Supreme Court has said will come into effect if the people ever amend the Constitution to permit ballot measures. So if we amend the Constitution, an issue that has to be decided is whether you would want the limits that are set forth in Measure 47 from 2007 to go into effect, or whether you would want them not to go into effect. There are various ways of doing that. You could you could repeal the statute, which is essentially ballot Measure 47. You could, in separate legislation, you could delay, you could make it so the constitutional provision would only apply to laws that were passed after the fact, or you could just let Measure 47 come into effect and be argued on its merits whether or not it is constitutionally sound. One option that came forward in the 2015 legislative session was in the initial Senate Bill 75. Senate Bill 75, essentially what it did in the introduced version was it repealed that ballot measure 47, and it set forth contribution limits that were at the level of the then current level of the federal contribution limits indexed for inflation. If you want to pass limits, those ones are the ones that are probably, I mean, they're the most likely right now to be upheld as constitutional. There are limits under the U.S. Constitution where courts have said that what states have proposed are simply too low, and that are unconstitutionally low, and they. One of the main concerns with that is that they would protect incumbents too much. One other issue is that even assuming that you wanted to just implement the federal contribution limits, there is still some uncertainty as to those limits. After recent cases of Citizens United, Supreme Court cases of Citizens United, and then McCutcheon, thank you. What those cases did, neither of those cases related to individual contribution limits. They did, however, talk about the justification for contribution limits, or the justification for imposing limits in this way, and they really said that the only basis for imposing these limitations would be to stop quid pro quo corruption or the appearance of such. And courts have been very uncertain, and people ever since that first came out in Citizens United have been very unclear what that really means going forward for any type of individual federal contribution limits. Then Oregon is in the Ninth Circuit. In May of this year, the Ninth Circuit was analyzing a claim that was challenging contribution limits passed by Montana. And it looked at what the trial court had done, and it said that they had analyzed it in an incorrect manner following Citizens United and McCutcheon. And they said that after Citizens United, what constitutes a sufficiently important state interest to justify limits on contributions has changed, Now the prevention of quid pro quo corruption or its appearance is the only sufficiently important state interest to justify limits on campaign contributions. Before Citizens United, it was enough to show the state's interest was simply to prevent the influence contributors of large sums have on politicians or the appearance of such influence. No longer so. They remanded the case back to the trial court to apply this new standard and figure out whether the limits apply. No one really knows what that's going to look like. So it's very hard to tell at this point, at least for me, what that really means. But it does mean that anything, it is something to keep in mind if the task force decides that it wants to do contribution limits, that is really there should be some type of effort to make it comply with that standard, and a belief that this anything you do would work within that standard, because at least as of now, that is the standard that the Ninth Circuit is saying that it is going to look at. And again, Oregon is in the Ninth Standard, or the Ninth Circuit. So that's campaign contributions. The only other thing that I guess I was asked to talk briefly about are disclosure requirements, which are a very popular topic and something I think a lot of people have interest in. In general, federal law is pretty supportive of requiring disclosure. Even a case like Citizens United was very pro-disclosure. Oregon law is very unclear about what kind of disclosure can and cannot be required. There is a test called the Robertson test, where you look at anything that's talking about speech or political speech. You look at whether it was written at the substance of speech or if it's forbidding speech on expression. And a lot of the lines for these cases based on legislation are very unclear, and there just have been relatively few cases that have looked at these for us to give significant guidance on. One thing that I think is worth pointing out is that, you know, in the 1990s, there was a law that we had. It was ORS 260.522 that required the identification of a source on any political publication. So, you know, if there was a banner, it needed to say paid by. In 99, the Attorney General issued an opinion saying that this was unconstitutional under Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution because it was directed at anonymous political speech per se, and that it was therefore unenforceable. After several years, the legislature then repealed that statute in 2001. The case never made it to court, but there have not been any cases since 2001 that would, at least to my knowledge, would change the way the Attorney General's office may think about some of those. So it is something also to be aware of. And the Supreme Court, you know, one of the only recent cases they've had that has looked at any campaign finance issue was in 2010. There was a case called Moyer, where the Supreme Court upheld statutory prohibitions against making campaign contributions in a false name. And it said that even though this was directed at speech, there was a historical exception against that type of fraud, so it was okay. But as it was making that claim, it was also noting that, you know, even the way the current law works is that it prohibits, current campaign finance law in Oregon prohibits anonymous contributions. And that's one of the only ways that it can work. But it was very clear to say that it was not even willing to say at that point that Article 1, Section 8 actually protected a law prohibiting anonymous contributions, but that wasn't before it, so it wasn't going to comment on it. And I guess my point there is not to say that anonymous contributions are a particular problem. It's just to show how much of campaign finance law is really undetermined yet under Oregon law. And that most things that you do, it would be an interesting, I mean, honestly, just in terms of giving advice, it would be great to have significantly more cases explaining what the law is. But it's, in some ways, it is hard to offer significant guidance on exactly where the limits of what, even under disclosure, are permissible under Oregon law, knowing only that it is more restrictive than federal law would be.
Have some any questions? I had a few things in.
I had one question, Dan, and I apologize if you touched on this and I missed it. But so the referral in SJR 5 amended a different section of the Oregon Constitution. It was Article 2, Section 8 instead of Article 1, Section 8. Can you talk a little about, and that was a new approach to my knowledge from previous efforts.
So Chair Atkins, Senator Rosenbaum, I think rather than amend Article 1, Section 8, SJR 5 amended Article 2, Section 8, and I think that was that. I think that it would still do the job to have an express. Based on the way the Supreme Court would analyze it, it would do the job to have an express permission to limit campaign contributions, and it does work within Article 2, Section 8. I think the reasons to do it may be more that you don't want to really have any suggestion that you're trying to affect free speech in any way, except you are just having this small carve out, and there, it's possible that having it in having the amendment in a different section would do that better. I think from just a practical standpoint, either one would have the effect. It would be very clear what the people are voting on, and that they would be voting to amend the Constitution to permit limits on campaign contributions. In a particular set, so that it would still be effective under this. That said, the current Oregon jurisprudence is definitely based on Article 1, Section 8 in terms of why campaign contributions are not permissible. But I do think that even amending this article would still get you around that.
And just to follow up, this bill came from the Secretary of State's office, not this Secretary of State at the time, but I assume that the reason this section was used is because it does talk about undue influence, and that gets to your corruption
yes.
connection. It talks about bribery, uses the word bribery. But I also would think that a court probably would consider a challenge, even if it was amending this section, that it still would have to comply with other sections of the Constitution, right?
That is correct.
But I think, I'm assuming that's why this is the approach that's taken here. So
I am sure that is a part of it.
Thanks.
I wanted to point out, before we get too much further, that there are materials which are up on our website, and please let anybody, let me know or Aaron know if that sort of whole, I think it's wonderful since I left the legislature, they now have all of this stuff, so easily accessible online, and we have our own website within there for the task force. And so there are materials, plus a basic background brief that's among those things that Legislative Committee Services puts together, plus some national information from National Conference of State Legislators on these issues. So don't feel like if some of this is new to you that if you missed it, in this listening that you don't have other resources to hear from. And please do note as we go along if there are things that you feel like would be helpful. The open meeting requirement was a good example of speaking up to ask for that. So copies of, I'm thinking to myself, maybe we want to post a copy of the bills that were introduced. And I'd also like to just quickly say that the creation of this task force arose out of the debates around those two bills. And also, I think we need a little bit of a vehicle to sort of bounce these legal concepts up against. But that's the reason to kind of think about them in that context. But this discussion, I hope, is going to be also a little bit more general as to other kinds of things, such as Dan talked about the impact on disclosure and kind of the limits of where people might go in that regard. Are there other questions, Dave?
Just for those of us who aren't as familiar with the Oregon Constitution as we should be, what does Section 8 of Article 2 address?
Section 8 of Article 2 currently says the Legislative Assembly shall enact laws to support the privilege of free suffrage, prescribing the manner of regulating and conducting elections, and prohibiting under adequate penalties all undue influence therein from power, bribery, tumult, and other improper conduct.
Thank you.
I'm going to pass an anti-tumult statute. we can do that if we want. So, Justin.
Question. You talked a little bit about anonymous political communication, and I'm curious your opinion today or at a later date how that fits in with Oregon's disclosure scheme around independent expenditures. There is indeed a filing that's supposed to be made in Oregon when a PAC or an individual makes an independent expenditure. And based on personal research, it wasn't abided by very consistently before the last couple of years. And there's added attention around those requirements. So can you comment on that today or maybe educate us at a later date if that requirement in Oregon is on firm footing? Is it enforceable?
It's definitely, my understanding is it's enforceable and being enforced, and it has never been challenged, and it's been around for quite a while. I can, if it would be helpful, I'd be happy to conduct more of an analysis.
But maybe you can contrast that, though, from what you're saying around limits on.
So that I would actually need to do a. I'd actually like a little time to do that, to do a full Robertson analysis.
I guess, and the reason I'm asking, one of my issues is exactly that, the quality of disclosure around independent or separate expenditures. I think it's woefully inadequate. And I don't know if we can or should look at doing more in Oregon around that. And if we try to go further, are we on firm legal footing to do so?
I would be, Chair Adkins. Mr. Delaney, I would be very happy to do some research on that for the next meeting.
Not questions? Are there other things people think
another,
we should on the table?
Okay. One more question. I'm aware in the Oregon Constitution there is a provision stating that contributions need to be from the district where the candidate is. And I understand that it was struck down by the Ninth Circuit at some point. Are you familiar with this, and could you give me some of the reasoning behind that? Because that seems to be another aspect of not just limits, but limits based upon geography. Is that permissible?
Chair Adkins, Mr. Markley, I am very familiar that it was struck down by the Ninth Circuit, but not of the reasoning. So I can I would be happy to look at that as well. That would be helpful,
please.
Was that a statutory?
It was a constitutional.
It was a constitutional ballot measure
of 94.
Okay.
I think.
Okay. Dave. Dave R.
I'm not expecting an answer here, but one thing I guess I would ask that might for a do a little due diligence on, and then come back with some, at a future meeting, is just a little bit of a review of the case law around public financing systems. Since I'm imagining that's going to be a part of our discussion, or at least I intend to bring that up. And so that might be just useful background, because the courts have kind of said a little bit of, you know, do this, but don't do that. And so that just might be helpful.
Absolutely.
Seth.
So when the federal government finds issues with limits, or when the federal courts find issues with limits at certain levels, do they tend to repeal the limits entirely, or do they raise them to some amount?
I believe they've just struck them down.
So would it make sense to maybe in a proposal put in like tiered amounts that if a court were to find? Yeah, because I know that Measure 47 has all this if language in it. If you could have backup protections, does that make any sense?
Chair Atkins, Mr. Woolley. So in general, we don't prefer drafting statutes that are conditional in that way. I have to think about it a little more to see if we could. I think it would be hard to have several tiers anyway. Let me think about that a little more.
Let me comment quickly. It would seem like a court might feel they were becoming a trier of fact, trying to determine whether each one kind of the standards, and that might be a reason for them. But I'll leave it to you to come up with the real answer. That's my made-up answer.
With independent expenditures,
yep.
What are, or if you could kind of clarify maybe now or another point, what are the minimum limits for how much an independent expenditure is where it must be required to be disclosed? So how low can an expenditure be where it still must be required to be disclosed in ORSTAR? And then is there any case law saying that, you know, there, you know, what the floor would be, whether it needs to be lower or higher, or where it should be set?
Let's point to Alana Cox from the Elections Division. You're talking about what the ORSTAR limits are, putting her on the spot to necessarily answer off the top of her head and not be able to follow up with a written something, which might be useful, but whatever information you're comfortable. Please come up. I'm sorry.
Alana Cox from Elections. The threshold is $750 right now.
I'll leave the legal analysis to Dan.
And I'm not aware of any cases that have challenged that limit.
Okay.
Brent, did you have something, or did I miss a? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, Representative Brayfield.
Mr. Cooper, could you provide us I do better visually than, you know, discussing some of the stuff. Could you provide us a list of all of the relevant cases in Oregon on campaign finance, and also I think it would be good to have the cases that Mr. Rosenfeld was talking about, and then also on the federal level, and then anybody can Google them and look them up. So most probably won't want to, but
those exist from some another that you don't have to gather, and from another resource we could add in.
I can definitely do that. Just a list of cases, or
just a list. Like I can research them.
Yeah, that's easy enough.
Dangerous offer to make, Representative Rayfield. I'll be reading cases in our extra time, and maybe there is in the one.
There's already a partial list in the materials for the meeting. One of the attachments.
Right, the NCSL.
Some reference that I don't believe are in the list.
Right. Let's see if there are gaps in that list. Fair enough. And any list is always changing. We may have changing law as we speak. So, Norman, is it comfortable with people that I'm using first names? If you'd rather
I'm
not.
Nate.
Okay. Sorry. Should have asked.
I'm sure you're all aware that there's several proposed amendments to the U.S. Constitution that may modify the First Amendment in the process. and they're motivated by the Citizens United case particularly, but they also go back as far as Buckley versus Vallejo in the 1970s in possibly their effects. And I just wanted to throw out the notion that we should, whatever we do, be keep flexible in our proposals so that we might also be able to take advantage of any U.S. constitutional amendment that might come down the pike. It might take 20 or 30 years to actually get there, but it's not entirely unlikely, let's put it that way. So, for example, I'll claim the origin of the language of SDR 5 in that I led a coalition about a decade ago of led by the League of Women Voters and several other organizations that tried to induce the legislature at that time to pass some sort of campaign finance reform. And one of the things we did was draft a Oregon State constitutional amendment that is very similar to SDR 5, and that same language has apparently been introduced in nearly every legislative session since. And it was just the same one sentence with the one small difference in that it also would have allowed expenditure limits in addition to contribution limits. And that was an anticipation of possible changes at the federal level, even though the Oregon Constitution might enable expenditure limits, the federal constitution still prohibited any expenditure limits. So I just wanted to also make aware of this possibility if we were thinking about a constitutional amendment that we should maybe consider. Did I make myself clear? And we agonized, by the way, on every word of that proposed constitutional amendment for, I think, like 3 hours.
Agony is part of this process. Get ready.
So one potential alternative to directly limiting contributions would be to reduce the effect of or the corruptibility of an actual donation by putting a restriction on when a donation is received or somebody's special interest advocate for a candidate, once they get in office and they actually are prepared to vote on an issue that a special interest may have brought before their body. What do you think about, are you familiar with restrictions on that, such as mandatory recusals, things that judges might have to do, but we could extend to legislators in the same way?
That was totally outside any thought that you had.
We have a constitutional requirement to vote.
I was going to say, I think that's going to run into, it would definitely take a constitutional amendment in Oregon at a minimum to do.
And say out loud why there is.
Oh, I'm sorry. There is a, again, I haven't looked at it, but I'm nearly certain there is a constitutional obligation for members to vote, and they, which is why in, you know, for example, conflict of interest members are unique in public officials in that they actually do have to, they do cast votes after declaring a potential or actual conflict of interest. So I think to get around that, you would actually, at a minimum, have to amend the Constitution to change that. But I'm pretty sure about that. I would need to look into that.
It's an interesting question because local government officials do have the ability to recuse themselves from voting on things where they have an actual conflict. But in Oregon, as Representative Rayfield pointed out, we have to vote after declaring a conflict, and people frequently declare a conflict of interest that really isn't a conflict of interest. I mean, it's supposed to be a direct financial conflict that isn't shared by a whole broad class of people. So I don't know whether that's in the Constitution or just it's in our
That's a specific question.
We can find out. Just as a practical matter, it's such a part of the institutional culture of the legislature that it would be a pretty radical change to just start having legislators not vote on things. I don't see that happening.
Well, I don't believe that they would necessarily be not voting on things. I think it might actually eliminate or create a disincentive to corrupting money in certain, like in cases. So
you mean the people would refuse contributions as a result of it?
Exactly. But yeah, if we could look at that.
I want to stabilize on that would be useful.
The only downside is trying to determine what legislation affects, you know, the different interest groups when so many of them. I mean, it would be, I think the clerk's office would have we'd have to double their staff.
One of my ideas on that is actually to require more resources for analyzing what industries are affected by what bills.
When we get to perusing ideas, we could start thinking about what those are a little bit later. I think when we get in a discussion of what kinds of values or standards we want to kind of test our ideas against, probably legality is going to be the first one. But good start of debate on the question of whether or not there's a way for the public to understand more fully what the potential impact of money is, which more than one member of the task force did mention to me as a topic of interest to them. So, but understanding the conflict of interest rules that affect the legislature and others might be a useful starting place for that. Questions? Any others? And again, we do have some things that outline these things. Thank you, Dan, for being willing to follow up with perhaps some written answers to questions or answers at our next meeting that have been asked. And if folks run across or have resources that they think are particularly good on any of these topics, again, share them with Aaron, share them with me. We'll get them up on and have them as part of the meeting materials that will help. So Dan has other things to do today as well. We're not the only task force in town. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dan.
I wonder if I might take a moment to ask whether, having heard this sort of overview of the constitutional provisions and kind of where we stand now with that and some of the good questions that have been raised, whether there are other sort of overview things that would be important to have. Some people know ORSTAR inside and out. Other people may not have worked with it or understand the statutory background for it. That might be something that we could add into an informational meeting in order to make sure that everybody's kind of got the same understanding. Would that be of interest to the group to happen? Or do you want to ask the questions as they come up? Which would be another alternative.
It's not a specific question, but as we talked about on the phone, I think at some point we will inevitably talk about who spends what in Oregon on elections. It might be more work than it's worth, but if it's something that your office could pull together, I think this group would benefit from a rudimentary analysis of individual contributions versus political action committees, and then you could dice the PACs further by union-affiliated, business-affiliated, that type of thing, just kind of some general buckets, and realizing it might be impossible because the PACs all have ridiculous, flowery names about kittens and puppies. So it's worth looking at least, I think, and if you decide it's something that we could get, that would be very beneficial. And the reason I ask is prior campaign finance reform task forces, we did not have adequate information. There's a lot of folklore about how much certain groups spend in elections in Oregon, and we never got clear information.
Good idea.
A good request. That was an issue that came up in the context of talking about the SJR 5 and a little bit about SB 75 as well as, and I think that maybe an appropriate place for that to come in, but I'm happy to begin thinking about how we could do it, would be when we're trying to judge the effect of something that we might put forward, understanding so the current situation and how that might impact that would be.
Madam Chair, members of the task force, there was a document put together by the Secretary of State's office during the legislative session in response to a senator's question when we were talking about Senate Bill 75 and SJR 4 that identifies the top contributors individually and by PAC in 2014. It's a basic document, but it will begin to kind of shed some light to start on the very question you just asked, Mr. Delaney, and I will get that posted right now onto OLIS. And so that will at least start that conversation.
And that was statewide candidates.
It was.
What we
that
focused
is correct.
On. That was the
correct.
Question that was asked. And so it doesn't reflect necessarily legislative contributions and others. So very good. Very good. Indeed.
It might also be helpful on, I believe, a C. Website for the National Institute of Money and Politics has a really great document that has a comparison of the average amount that candidates for state house, statewide office, and you have judicial candidacy and so on and so forth have to raise on a state-by-state analysis. So how much do candidates for the Oregon State House versus candidates for the Florida State House have to raise? I think it's the National Institute for Money and Politics, and they have a really great chart. So if there's a way to include that, I think that might be helpful.
And if you have a quick link, I suspect that our committee staff is very adept at finding things by general names. But if you have a link and can send it to her, that's always going to reassure that it gets to the one that you're interested in. And so are there other things that occurred to you during there and say would like to get a briefing on that? And again, I think we're also very open to moving forward about that.
Well, it's in the documents that were posted for this meeting, but I think it'd be really interesting to look at what other states' law is that has been functioning and apparently not overturned by the courts, because it's frequently said in this discussion that we're one of a handful of states that doesn't have any limits. And I don't know who put this NCSL document in the packet, but it does go state by state and show what the state's laws are. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if somebody would want to present that, or we get somebody from NCSL on the phone. I don't know if they have experts in this area, but
they absolutely do, and they are always willing to participate in these types of discussions, whether on the phone or in person. So that's certainly for our next meeting, we could certainly contact them and have their best recommendations and or individual come or be on the phone with us. So that's always an option, absolutely.
Well, Senator Rosenbaum, I guess one question would be, are there other states that have constitutional provisions on free speech that are as strong as in the Oregon Constitution?
Good. Well, it's too bad that we don't have Dan in the room anymore, but I think most states do have some equivalent, but I think what is true in Oregon is that our Supreme Court has interpreted it very broadly. So obviously, unless you want the starting place to be, there's nothing we can do. I think it is helpful to look at, because there's the federal constitution as well as the state constitution, and I don't know, maybe somebody else does, whether since these U.S. Supreme Court decisions, more of these laws at the state level have been getting thrown out, but somebody who specializes in this area around the country probably could tell us that pretty easily.
That seems to be something that recurs continually in the discussion here in Oregon, is because of the Oregon Supreme Court decisions that imposes very significant limits on what we can do in terms of campaign finance, and so that would be interesting to see, are we unique in that regard, or are there other states that have had to address similar limitations?
Certainly a question we can have. We have at least, as often we often do with Oregon folklore, that our state constitution's Bill of Rights is very special, and we do have some jurisprudence that has spoken to that and a lot of focus on our Oregon constitution in that way. But it may well be there are four other states who are, you know, mm-hmm. or the clearly that, and we just haven't heard that. Rob?
Thanks. I think that Oregon's constitution on free speech is based upon Indiana's constitution. And Indiana has some case law on it, not to say that the Oregon Supreme Court would interpret it exactly the same, but it does provide guidance to us. But if you want to get a whole book full of constitutional guidance on this, you could amend the Oregon Constitution to say that as far as political speech, contribution expenditures, the Oregon Constitution shall be interpreted exactly like the federal Constitution. And that could be a constitutional amendment presented to the people. You would all of a sudden have years of history on this. All you have to do is look to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the benefit behind that, and I don't want to get too much into proposals here at this point, obviously, but the benefit behind that is if, for instance, Citizens United were overturned down the road, we wouldn't have to go back to the Oregon Constitution. We would know the guidance to that. And so there is some benefit to that, because you're always going to have to look at the federal Constitution anyway after doing a constitutional analysis. So by saying, carve out a very specific Oregon constitutional amendment that says, just as far as political speech and expenditures, nothing else, because there's other things covered by, obviously, Article 1, Section 8, shall be interpreted like that. All of a sudden, we've just adopted the federal regimen for analysis.
Well, oh, go ahead, Norman. I always prefer the task force members to me.
Well, I don't want to answer him, so if you had a comment on what he was saying.
No, I was going to shift a little bit, so please.
Well, I think having quickly looked through the materials that we provided, I didn't see much information about public financing of elections. And there's a broad range of schemes that have been proposed or actually implemented across the country. On this from, you know, partial funding through matching contributions to voter-owned elections to vouchers and so on. And the Oregon still has its $50 tax credit in place, although that's been limited now. Anyway, it might be useful to have some background on what those schemes have been and which ones have been actually in use in different parts of the country, and if there's any case law in any of that, that would be useful for our considerations as well.
The one sort of little bit of a summary comment, not to end this discussion at all prematurely, but just that I took away from Legislative Council presentation here is that we've been operating on an assumption, maybe not all of us, but at least in the discussion that was happening this session, on the absolute necessity of moving the bar a little bit in some way on the Oregon Constitution in order to get at contribution limits, which was the other bill that the previous secretary had introduced. I think one of the takeaways from this presentation for me is that as we even approach disclosure things, related things, we're going to have to come up against that same question, and so, you know, it isn't just a question of we can't do contribution limits. We may have some barriers around disclosure ideas that people bring forward here, and we probably have less specific guidance around that, but something that we will want to be aware of as we go forward. So Erin is writing madly, and I know thinking about, and we'll put our heads together on what are some of the best resources to get in front of you, some of which maybe we'll ask you to absorb on your own time, and some of which we'll have somebody, you know, help, you know, walk us through and understand. I hear people wanting to make sure they understand the reality of where we where our state situation falls with respect to others, making sure we understand parameters around public financing, being aware of how the national situation could change as the response to particularly Citizens United, but even the original money equals speech finding of the Supreme Court might do, and being ready for the future as opposed to assuming that stays forever. All right, there are others that I should note that we want a little bit of a better understanding on the independent expenditure filing requirements in Oregon, whether there's some issues there. And a good list of Oregon cases to go with our federal cases. And there may be more, so don't panic if I haven't mentioned it. I think staff will do a great job with that. Yes, Seth.
So as part of this committee, do you think it would make sense if we investigated and identified instances of actual or appearance of corruption to give to the legislature as material that it might use in crafting legislation, such that when it comes for court review, I mean, they would have that. Like, good. Is that something that could be a part of our report or a later report?
I want to say never, but we'll try to figure out how that might come in context as we evaluate certain proposals, whether what would be the best way to make the case for those, and what's possible in the way of making the case for those. That would seem an appropriate.
I'm just very data driven. I hate to approve anything without actual data.
Some information. My the next piece of our agenda was to have a discussion a little bit more broadly about the objective of the task force and work plan and goals. I don't know if folks are interested in being able to either run to the restroom or have a new cup of coffee in front of them before we start that discussion, but I'm happy to do that. Take a 10-minute break to come back at 10:35, let's say, since we went past 10:20. Give us a chance to kind of absorb, and then hopefully what I'm hoping for that section is a little bit of brainstorming as opposed to decision making, just to kind of see where but I won't make you put dots on lists. Doc, many of you have been through that process, I'm sure, in your life. We'll try to avoid that. So thank you. We'll go, Campos. I'd like to bring the group back together. So our next section is to talk a little bit about the objective of the task force, work plan, and goals. I know that there are a whole lot of ways that we could organize this discussion, and every one of you has led groups and been in groups and have your thoughts about how you ought to get from point A to point B. But if you'll bear with what I felt like was the simplest way and the way to get the most information for us from you all in this early meeting, so that we could then really be clear about setting the rest of the agenda, I'd appreciate your patience with my version of this. So House Bill 2178 had the call for the task force to complete was to conduct an analysis and determine the best method, thank you, or methods to address campaign finance reform. pretty broad and pretty pretty nonspecific as to how that would happen. The other specific mandate is that we submit a report, which may include recommendations for legislation, to the House and Senate Interim Committees on Rules no later than 12/31/15. We don't have to quit there. We don't die at that time. There is the potential for us to go on. It actually statutorily expires in June 30th of 2017. So if we have started on good work and are not ready to talk to the legislature about it, that's the opportunity to continue forward. You'll have a new secretary in January of 2017, so might have to have a transition there if the folks are still going strong. But I've talked a little bit with most of you, not all of you as yet. My sense is that folks are interested in the practical, something that's really going to be effective, but also in applying and considering certain values that we ought to bring to bear to the various ideas. I don't think it's going to be very easy immediately to draw a straight line from a jointly held definition of the problem, what's wrong we're trying to fix, to the strategies that become the best methods that the statute calls for us to evaluate. I think we might have to go back and forth a little bit early on between some of those things, so I'm hoping that the focus problem solvers among you will be a little bit patient as we maybe do a little bit swinging back and forth and we get all the concerns and ideas and issues out on the table. I'm going to ask that we focus our discussion today in three areas and do some brainstorming. One is your version of what you think the problem is we're trying to solve. A second one for folks who are kind of anxious to get to the ideas that people have. What are the ideas that you want to make sure that we discuss? And we've had a little bit of help with that already in your request for some background information on certain things. And then third, you know, what you think the most important values are that we ought to be thinking about as we evaluate these ideas. And not to be an immediate thief, but an example that I would steal from one of you who shall remain nameless at the moment unless they want to volunteer it, but you know, we might want to apply an Oregon standard, what works for us here in Oregon, as opposed to perhaps adopting things that have automatically that have worked well. So I'm hoping that we can have staff, when we get to the end of this discussion, have some lists in each of those areas to work from, and that we can report back to you and begin to see sort of where are the common threads that might be helpful for starting place, and certainly what are some of the issues that we want to do that. If we do have public audience that signed up, I don't know that we do as yet. Nope. But if we did, I'd ask them to answer the same questions, and maybe they didn't want to be scripted, so they didn't show up today.
Could you just quickly give us those three questions?
Sure. I'll go through them individually as well as we started back. But I think the first one that I asked was, what is the problem? How do you identify the problem? Several people talked about, okay, what problem is it we're trying to solve? So everybody comes to this with a little different sense of this. Second would be, what are the ideas that you want to make sure that we at least explore? Ideas that you may have heard about, and that could be small or large. And practicality is certainly a value in the third category. But at this point, let's get everything out there that we can. And third, what are kind of the most important values you think we ought to be thinking about as we evaluate those ideas? I mentioned earlier, legality sounds like one of them. Some practicality, and that's a general statement that obviously we could have some talk about what that means. And an Oregon solution might be another in that category. So ready to do some brainstorming? I think folks could do that. So first of all, on a problem statement, anybody got something what they think is the most important thing we're trying to solve here? We're into reform, so what are we reforming? Should we go around? Is it easier if we go around instead of, you know? start on this end this time?
I think we just maybe just as people just think of it, they go. I mean, I think there's a public perception that we want to change, you know, with what we're doing. And I think the perception behind that is that money dictates the decisions that are being made, you know, in the legislature.
We want to address that public perception. Beth?
I would think more than a public perception. I think there have been recent studies where they analyze the flow of money and then the actual votes versus the opinions of those who provide the money in the public. And I think it's real that that their money is making decisions. And that's the fundamental problem, that we expect a government of, by, and for the people, but what we're getting is the money influences are basically controlling the government. So it's become captured by special interests. And that's really the fundamental problem.
I think there's definitely a fundamental issue in terms of the cost of elections and the amounts that legislators and candidates for state office, and for local office too, have to raise is very exorbitant and I think higher than a lot of other states. High costs of elections are really problematic in terms of preventing other communities in Oregon from being able to run for office and low-income people from really being able to have access to decision making, or at least to feel that they have the ability to run, even if they do have the ability to run, to feel that they are empowered to be able to run for office too is really important. So I think, is the cost of elections prohibitive for certain communities being able to run for office in Oregon?
And I sort of echo that, taking it one step back from Representative Rayfield's comment. I think it's a public perception that money doesn't simply influence legislative decisions. It also influences and in some cases determines who gets elected and which ballot measures pass. And that's probably a little bit simplistic, but I think there is a public perception of that money drives the entire political system.
For our membership, I think for young people, they feel like there's not access for young people. So I think more with the perception of money, they have to pay to play. So their voice isn't being heard, and they're being excluded from that process.
When it comes to the point that Daniel raised about participation and not being able to afford to participate because election costs are too high, there's a problem on the low end, too, that the existing regulations for disclosure create a barrier to entry themselves because they're complex and you have to learn about them and you have to spend time to deal with them. And raising those low barriers to higher limits would actually invite greater participation by other people in the political system. They might not still be able to afford to win the election, but it would be easier for them to get their foot in the door, which may lead to that later.
I would offer that that the problem isn't too much money in politics, but that the problem is really just too much big money in politics, and that's what drives everything. That the Supreme Court doesn't actually have it completely wrong, that the act of giving political of any kind of contributions and giving money and raising money is a gorgeous, beautiful act of expression, and that in fact the more people in our democracy that were giving money, their own money, and the more people that were raising money to try to influence and get their ideas out there would be better. It's what the problem is that it's just too much big money, and unlike in the economic sphere where I think there's a consensus that we tolerate a degree of inequity to have, you know, whatever kind of entrepreneurialism that we have, and then we fight over exactly how to rectify that. In the political space, we do need more equality when it comes to the money that's in the system, because we have a principle of one person, one vote, and that's what the problem is that it's just too much big money, not too much money.
To echo some of the other things around, I think that I agree it's not
too much money in the system. The money, I mean, the system is expensive, and to run political campaigns and to do that work, it's the limiting factor that creates for candidates to be able to participate, and it's driving people out of the ability to participate. So how do we actually increase participation, knowing that there's still money that is involved in campaigns and elections and things like that? So how do we still create avenues for people to participate through, you know, through other venues and things like that? Because the money's going to come in one shape or form. Mm-hmm. So squeezing it out to another area isn't that. Is it? How do we empower more people?
And I hope when we get to the values piece, we come back to that whole issue of the impact,
yes,
potentially,
sir.
of no, that's okay. It was didn't mean to dispute. You were in the right category, but I just want to make sure we kind of repeat that on a value side, because I heard that from several folks. You know, don't make a choice that's going to make something worse on the other end. So, Norman.
Well, I would add to what Nikki said to say that it's really access for any group of people who have trouble working in the system as it now is, and it could be, you know, gender groups, or it could be ethnic groups or religious groups and so on. And it just, the whole system is built towards maintaining the way it now works and keeping out people that don't have a lot of influence already.
Can I ask who came back on the phone?
Representative Gilley.
All right. And please speak up if you would like to add into what we're doing, a little bit of brainstorming to see where folks are on. First question being, what's the problem we're trying to solve? And if you have a thought about that, please.
Well, one of the problems, if this is a good time, Madam Chair, is a state representative calling in instead of being in the room, because I can't hear a lot of what's being said.
Okay.
And I don't blame you for that. It's just technology. I thought that I was representing the House, but I'm pleased that Representative Rayfield at least sent his bearded older brother. Now,
you're watching us, aren't you? As well.
Yes, and it's 30-second delay. Real quickly, the money issue that I heard as a problem is undeniable. There is the far end of deep pockets and lack of transparency. Then there's also of the very fuzzy line in Oregon between public employee unions and the use of state apparatus to both raise money and distribute money. And I think while it's not the key to election reform, it is certainly a problem to be addressed.
Thank you, and we will ask folks if we will. Our mics are feeding into this, are they? So if we would take more judicious use of our microphones that move back and forth. I'm right by the phone. I'm hoping that he hears me.
Or is it the phone?
The microphone, it's both. Hopefully it's picking up the microphone through the speakerphone. It's not a perfect system.
So we want to make sure Vic can hear us.
Yes.
Right. So we'll try to do better in terms of the volume of folks speaking. But we also really want to have you in the room. So we'll
thank you very much.
That's wonderful. Okay.
Secretary, I have a few that I'll put out there. I agree with the folks who said there's absolutely too much money in politics. And I don't think that volume of money is from any one type of source. I think there's just plain too much money. When we have legislative seats in Oregon crossing the $1 million threshold, I find it hard to believe that that's not a problem. I think the power of incumbency is a problem, present company excluded. This isn't about any individuals. It is impossible on the state or federal level to unseat an incumbent minus a scandal. And I don't think that's the way representative democracy is intended to work. I think the, as I mentioned earlier, independent expenditures are woefully underreported in Oregon. And those are really hard to get at because you've got this amorphous definition of uncoordinated expenditures. I don't quite know how to explain it, but you know it when you see it. And then the last problem that I would throw on the table is what I was discussing with Daniel earlier, and it's the proliferation of PACs, I call it. You can have one entity or, you know, whether it's a activist group or a union or a business group, doesn't matter, but the shell game of PACs that are created to really for no purpose other than to make it hard for the public to see how money is spent and where it's coming from.
Are you talking about pass-throughs?
Pass-throughs are part of that, yes.
So I would agree with those who have said that there is way too much money being spent at a state level on running for office in Oregon. I think it's been years since a single House campaign went over $1 million. I think that may have happened way back in 2005 or so. And I also agree that there is a perception and maybe a reality among the public that some people have a much bigger microphone. I think that was the governor's phrase when they come and ask for something than people who don't have resources to play at a financial level. I also think one of the biggest problems is that there is a sense of frustration among people, maybe shared by some at this table, that we can't do anything in Oregon. That we look at this grid of states around the country and we see that we're one of only six states that has, I think, strong disclosure laws, but not much else in terms of any limits about where money can come from or how much. And I think that's one of the biggest problems because, I mean, like some others here, I've been in lots of these groups through the years, and they meet and meet and meet and collect information, but very rarely is there any outcome. So I think, to me, that is one of the biggest problems, is people feel that their hands are tied either by the courts or a lack of consensus about what to do, and I would hope that there's something concrete that can come out of here.
We covered the waterfront here. I can't believe it. Anybody else out?
Well, on the point of access, I wanted to point out that individuals who don't have a lot of money often have a hard time even scheduling a meeting with a representative. And that was just one effect of lack of access.
Let me go to the microphone. Taken down to a daily level of that's in the conversation.
Not to disagree, but simply stating a fact, it's hard for lots of groups to get up with legislators.
Legislators take a hit.
Present company excluded.
Present company excluded. Well, it's just,
I know for a fact, Mr. Delaney, you never attempted to pick it up.
It's just Ray Field I was talking about. It can be very hard for all groups, and I think there's a public perception problem there, the microphone argument that, you know, whether it's a large individual donor or a company or a union, my experience has been the fact is if a legislator has largely made up their mind and session has gotten busy and they know what you're going to say, they're not going to schedule a meeting with you sometimes.
But maybe I might mention my employer is Uber. Just as an example of access bias.
All the politics of Portland just went zzzt when you said that.
Well,
we got to run politics.
I think I'll take on my role as being the contrarian for just a moment. I don't think the problem is money or too much money, because in electioneering, money primarily is speech, and speech is a good thing, and the answer to bad speech is more speech. The problem is only when we see that the money is influencing votes and causing the government to do something that it wouldn't otherwise have done for special interest. So please, let's not attack money per se, but the consequences, the non-speech consequences of money.
Well, I would, as a representative from, you know, the community-based organization advocacy sector, I would add that, you know, we echo a lot of the thoughts that have been raised around excess and transparency. And one of the things I would also raise is, you know, we talk a lot and we do a lot of efforts with civic engagement in our communities. We have programs to engage many of our community members, you know, specifically a, you know, a program, for example, looking at leadership pipelines. How do we develop leadership and advocacy for these community members? And frankly, there's a limit to that. You know, we have a program that does leadership development to get our community members onto boards and commissions. So in a very real and tangible way, you know, it's beyond the money. It's a way to kind of, I don't know if it's too idealistic to try to solve, but it's at least a way to kind of address that disconnect that the community is feeling, the disillusionment, that, you know, how do we bridge the community engagement piece with, of, you know, developing that pipeline beyond just very particular limited leadership roles for our community members. So I just figured I'd just add that from the community-based organization perspective, that it really, I think, will help us broaden our ideas of engagement and how the community can participate.
There's been a little discussion of public perception versus reality, I guess I just think we at some point will have to kind of make a determination whether responding to perception probably also still needs to be tested against, are we solving reality? The farther we go down the path of trying to prove the reality, the harder it might get and the more negative the conversation might get. And I don't want to prevent negative conversations, but I also just want to acknowledge that. You know, part of our job, I think, here is to also offer up to the legislature some ways to think about this and talk about it, because other proposals will come their way. Also, I think we have a good opportunity to give something that could be a public, you know, document as well, as things come to them in the form of ballot measures. We're not the only game in town. You probably know we're going to live in a context of other folks will be bringing forward things. So I do think, and I might push folks a little bit as we go forward to, you know, think about what are the kind of principles that we agree on and help us kind of get past the barrier. Do we have to prove it, you know, is perception always all of it? You know, what's kind of the midpoint that we get to, and what are the other ways we can test our ideas? So a little bit of a weird thought, and might not have been very well expressed, but I'll try not to.
Add one more problem.
Sure.
Yes, I'm surprised nobody brought up out-of-state money in Oregon elections after we just went through a couple difficult ballot measure and candidate elections, even for the first time, to my knowledge, had very large contributions from a couple out-of-state wealthy folks.
Ask the question, and hopefully we'll have some good information on what is our power with respect to, you know, hoping.
And for ballot measure.
I think you'll say we're probably not 100% on the same page of exactly what we think the problem is, but I hope we'll kind of come back to this so we can, you know, see where the consensus is and as we start testing some of these things. Any other things? I don't want to move along. I'm not sure. Don't worry about going back if you want to go backwards. So for, as I said, for folks who may want to, let's get down to it here, and people have already talked a little bit about ideas they'd like to explore, but let's make sure we have a good list of what the issues are that you hope, or the proposals or ideas are that you want to be sure that we explore at some point during this meeting. Are you looking at me because you have one time?
Well, I do think a threshold question, obviously the group will continue on possibly after our initial report, but I think a threshold question is the constitutional amendment, because I think there's a lot of reason to believe that our hands are tied if we don't let the voters have a chance to amend the Constitution. So that I would put at the top of the list.
Okay, thank you.
I agree.
Okay. That's two dots.
Do you agree?
Well, we have some folks, not everybody's nodding enthusiastically, and I know I've had at least one conversation when people said, hard to make it a priority given some of the federal constitutional limits, but we'll continue to look at that. Norman.
Well, I think our disclosure system is probably one of the best in the country. That grew out of a task force about a decade that I also served on with Bill Back, Bill
Bradbury.
Excuse me. And that system is terrific as far as it goes. But there are a couple of holes in our disclosure system. One is around independent expenditures. There's really nowhere way to know where that money comes from, and this is the so-called dark money in the independent expenditures.
I'm going to ask you to be a little closer to your mic just in case we've got someone trying to listen.
Super PACs and dark money are part of that. The other idea is that people become confused about the sources of campaign advertising. And with PACs having nondescript titles like Citizens for Good Government or something, everybody's for good government, it seems. But it would be good to have further disclosure on the advertising that is done. And maybe in spite of the Attorney General's decision a few years ago that we maybe should test that in the courts.
I think we talk a lot about, if we do talk about limits, we talk about broad limits generally, like how much someone can raise when they run for office, and that's certainly valuable. But what are other regulatory schemes that are necessary for that limits can impact? So, like for instance, a lot of states have laws against raising money during the legislative session. We have a rule in the House; we don't have one in the Senate. But a lot of states have laws that, and that's one thing that could be really helpful. People are found to have violated campaign finance law before. Are there any, our lack of ability to put limits in place means that we can't take any punitive actions against people who violated the law before? That might be an area to discuss. So I guess kind of like, what are the smaller, more narrow areas where limits can be helpful, I think would be a really helpful way of looking at this too.
Penalties, probably a general category, but you're indicating penalties that are associated with your ability to continue fundraising or fundraising at certain limits if you violated things.
I'm surprised David hasn't brought this up yet, but public finance.
Okay, yes.
As an issue to wrestle with on this topic. I'll speak for you.
Yes.
I think the principle, as I think of it, is if we are limited in what we can do to reduce the amount of big money in the process, then that's true, but it is also true that we are less limited in what we can be doing to amplify the small donors in the process. And so it would behoove us, even if that may not get us to something that is ready for prime time or has a consensus for 2016, if we're here already, it would behoove us to think about what do we know in this country right now, what do we know about what is working and what isn't, both on the merits and then also what the voters seem to like in these places, because the world is changing and has changed quite a bit on these various kinds of systems that amplify small donors, and so we ought to at least get up to speed on what those things are and, you know, some sense of where people in the room stand on those things, even if that's not going to necessarily be the most practical thing that's going to come out of this session. And I've got some very particular ideas, and other people do as well, and, you know, at least I would advocate that be a part of the discussion, although acknowledge it's not going to be probably the thing that is the most tangible.
Take up like a snap, huh? Don't think so. No, very well taken. Nikki.
I think that we have really strong disclosure laws. Some of the things that I would like to see just as potential ideas is enforcement of the Secretary of State. So there's a number of complaints that happened last election cycle, and giving broad authority to the Secretary of State to do more fines. The fines are pretty minimal. And the complaints that were filed last election cycle, we saw them get investigated, but there wasn't anything that happened as a result of some of those. So giving more authority to the Secretary of State to really come down. And then for the some of the money side of things, we see people getting fined, but it's such a minimal amount that it's not detrimental to wait that extra 10 days or 7 days during election cycle if it's only going to be $200. So we saw a number of campaigns also do this in the last cycle where they waited to report different money that came in. So giving the Secretary of State, again, more authority would be really great. And then the last idea, we saw this again in the last election cycle, but with the digital targeting, finding ways to make sure that we increase the understanding of that digital target. So some campaigns did digital targeting with a $50 amount, so they fell under the paid for. So if we could increase some of those penalties too, so that it was $50 donations digitally, but like 20 or 40 times, which should fall under the, again, the Secretary of State's authority to be able to file complaint. So just some specific ideas from the last cycle, I think, on both, all parties, so.
I would say very briefly, in my short tenure, the Secretary of State, it has been interesting to sort of begin to understand that we have a very rigorous reporting system. Don't know that the legislature has thought through how whether or not the failure to comply, looking at as a reporting violation, is one that should be terribly serious or not. Sometimes it's a mistake, and so, you know, you want to say, okay, we're not going to give a huge penalty for something that's a mistake. Sometimes it's deliberate. How will we know? So not to get into the pros and cons of that, but that certainly has been. I know Senator Boquist, there's been others that you know, were really sort of asking that question, and I think that's a fair place for us to go. Rob.
And when we talk about disclosure, I think it's not just important, the ORSTAR and those sorts of reporting, but we should also be talking about disclosures on election campaign political material that's going out. So the primary financiers of each of these political pieces of information. And an anecdotal story I'll tell you about this, and I don't have all the facts particularly, but it was in California very recently. There was a city election. The oil companies had a financial interest in seeing who the city council was. They had a slate of candidates they were pushing. California has a disclosure law. The political election information went out, had to disclose who was financing these. They spent $2 million to get their slate of candidates elected. They lost to a group that spent $80,000. So disclosures of the election material that's going out can be very informative to the electorate. Like Kyle said, information is important. This is one of those things that if we know who's financing some of this material, it does two things. One, it lets the voters know who's backing these candidates, and that's good information to have, and they should be proud to back these candidates, I think, publicly. It also may take some of the edge off of the more problematic election material that goes out towards the end of the election cycle too, if they have to own the material that's sent out. So I think when we talk about disclosure, ORSTAR is very good. I like that. a lot of the disclosure. Those are very good ideas, Nikki. I like that. But we should be talking about the material that's going out, too. Oh, and public financing. I agree. The end.
Since I was mentioned, I guess I'll jump in here. It doesn't, anonymous political speech does not bother me. And in fact, I think it has a justified history in the U.S. history. The Federalist Papers, the Anti-Federalist Papers were anonymous political speech. And I don't want to limit that.
I have a quick question on that. What if they were required to say that this is an anonymous, like on disclosure, this is by an anonymous person? Like on the ad. Is that, would you allow that?
You can see that already.
Well, right now, they would normally see authorized by such and such, but if they see an ad that's like from an anonymous entity, then they could, you know, that would, depending on the content of it, that would change how one approaches that. I think it would be important.
That's a discussion. Jess, you hadn't raised, so pardon me if I jump in and raise for you the potential for getting the tools for general public to understand what they're looking at in a North Star, and this may be an amendment of things that you mentioned to me and you might want to add on to it. But for those of us who work in the system, we may go to North Star and get a lot of good information. For folks who, you know, don't, but, you know, have an interest, you know, are we presenting it in the clearest way? Is there summary, you know, things that could be provided or ways that people could evaluate, you know, what's there? And again, yeah. That's probably my version of what you said and not yours, but.
So on that, one idea was exactly for transparency, a lot of times you can't tell what the interests are by industry. There's standard codes for industry classifications, and we could require those to be part of the ORSTAR system. We could require them to be part of bills as they get published on the website. If we do a fiscal analysis, we can say what industries do these actually impact, so we could make the process more easy to see where the potential for corruption is. So that's some way of trying to identify corruption problems. Some of the my other ideas were something I raised earlier was the idea of at the time of vote recusal requirements and saying that campaign donations create a conflict of interest and potentially even donations that aren't direct donations, but independent expenditures that are explicitly for a particular candidate. Like we've seen in some rural, like smaller communities where people interested in getting some urban renewal funds will back a particular slate of candidates. And these might be really small towns where they only have to spend $10,000 or $20,000. But then they'll get their slate elected. And these are really meaningful like amounts, like $8 million or something. And that's a huge impact on the budget of a small city. So I see that a lot. Oregon City is an example. Or one of my friends was a commissioner who got attacked. There's also, I want to deal with the problem of pass-throughs that's been discussed, but I approve of that. On public financing, one thing I want to do, one thing I would like to stress on public financing is if you look at like the federal government, for example, on their public financing scheme, it's really hard for third parties to get access to that. And one of the problems with public financing as implemented in some jurisdictions is it's not been easy for grassroots campaigns to actually get that. But it's been structured by existing incumbents, so they make it easy for somebody to buy their way into public financing by having, say, allowing a certain amount of donations to go in that are larger, that they can then go collect smaller donations. In Portland, for example, they had this, so a lot of the commissioners would just pay their way into public financing really easily, but then you had grassroots people going out and collecting them by hand, having a hard time. They'd get halfway there, even though they were working full time at it. And so maybe there's a way to, now it's really hard to limit things to just volunteers, but that might be an area that hasn't undergone restrictions at the courts, like saying you have to have volunteers go collect the money that gets matched. That's one possible way. But making it so that you can't have money buying the public money. That's one thing that I think people would be really disgusted by. But I'm fully supportive of public financing. And in particular, if there's more we can do around giving just ballot-qualified candidates more publicity, there's the voter's pamphlet statement, but expanding on things like that, more opportunities, trying to negotiate with cable providers to get access to actually, like, maybe have the state do more on that, try to get the state promoting democracy and promoting access to candidates. I know the FCC has issues when we try to regulate television and radio broadcasts, but maybe there's something we could do around trying to level the playing field for people who just don't have a lot of money. And so that's...
So public opportunities as opposed to just public financing, but public opportunities that are collected. When I think back to our discussion of the problem, I don't know that anybody put on the table and would ask whether they would, whether public, the public getting enough information from candidates is a problem that you think is worth thinking about trying to address in this whole thing. Whether it's not just information about campaign finance, but others. I'll just throw that on the list from my standpoint. So we'll come back to you, Seth. Let's move around a little bit.
Just to throw it in the mix, since we're talking about it, we often don't talk about judicial elections specifically because judges kind of have a special role in our culture of, you know, being impartial and not having contributions affect their decisions, you know, in terms of their court decisions. So whether that's expanding disclosure around judges, whether that's, I know some states have public financing specifically for judicial candidates. You know, I've worked on judicial campaigns before, and technically judicial candidates are not allowed to ask for money. But what they do is they just kind of pass the phone over to the campaign manager, and in front of them, the campaign manager will ask a donor or potential donor to donate to the campaign. So maybe there are other steps we could do to remove judges from the process of asking for money that might be helpful. You can't, of course, completely inoculate them from awareness of it because that information is public. But maybe it's kind of removing them further from the process of making requests for donations.
Well, I'll just, fair notice, I might end up adding from the list things that you might have said to me over the phone. I won't put names attached to them that didn't get on this list for some reason, because I want to make sure that at least as we look at it in the beginning, we've got as many things on the list as we can. So, Seth, did you have one other thing that was a little different than the kind of public opportunities you were talking about that you wanted to add?
Well, yeah, I just wanted to reiterate Kyle's desire to see it easier for grassroots campaigns, and maybe we can consider slacking some of the transparency rules if they're like small donations or things of that nature. Because one of the things I've seen is small grassroots campaigns have a hard time finding treasurers willing to do it, to take on the legal liability. Some of the small campaigns have a hard time actually finding a bank. None of the credit unions will touch it that will even do it. Some people, their credit was so bad they couldn't open a bank account, so they couldn't even run for office. And I think it would be an interesting idea to have the state step in and manage some of the compliance issues. And maybe you can opt in to where, if you're willing to limit to $50 donations, the state will handle your bank account and everything, and they'll even manage the compliance for expenditures as well and write the checks for you. And that way, you could get people out of the business of having to manage this complex process.
In the spirit of the kitchen sink, on the issue of disclosure, if at whatever point we were talking about enhancements to ORSTAR, which I agree with, echo the statement that it's a really admirable system, that it would be good, I think, to think about if we were doing that, we would do it in conjunction with ways with which voters could seamlessly see the information that's in ORSTAR related to political contributions, the information that's already out there in corporate registrations, nonprofit registrations, and their boards, and then also the information that's out there, thanks to many of the lawmakers in this room, regarding the way that tax dollars are spent, in particular nonprofits and companies that are getting tax dollars either through contracts and tax breaks. And we've made strides in all of those areas in making that stuff much more transparent, but the information is very siloed. And it's really just an almost like Web 1.0 in its format. But a real Oregon would just take a massive leap forward on disclosure if that stuff became, you know, integrated and, you know, presented in a way that, you know, was Google-ish, I guess.
A couple minor issues, not really striking at the heart of campaign finance, but I hope I'm not the only one that feels that it's a little awkward to subsidize other people's political speech through a tax credit. I've never liked that system. I don't understand why it's in place in Oregon, and I think it actually serves a purpose very contrary to what most people think. It's used to fuel large PACs. The other one that I don't like at all in Oregon is what's happened to our voters' pamphlets. The paid arguments for and against. It's darn near impossible to find the candidates page in some of the voters' pamphlets when they arrive. They're an inch thick, and I don't know that there's a proposal that I have, but it would seem to me that the state is producing this document, and it ought to just be the facts, ma'am. And maybe a separate publication would contain arguments for and against.
You're talking about for ballot measures.
For ballot measures, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, it used to be we had so many ballot measures that that was a separate volume of the voters' pamphlet. I think the fact that we've had fewer ballot measures now is
fewer ballot
that
measures,
problem.
But bigger money ballot measures that have 100 arguments for and against in the voters' pamphlet with the state seal on it.
As a person who has submitted two arguments regarding ballot measures, don't take the argument section away.
No, I'm not suggesting
it's
take
the
it
only
away.
Vehicle that an individual like me would have to get a statewide audience for an argument.
Looking at that, I know we've had the situation arise of late where unclear whether the argument for was really the argument for or whether the argument against
those were fun.
Yes,
those.
And I think that did raise a feeling of, you know, is the system being used in a dishonest way, and that bothered a lot of people.
Is it satire or is it dishonest?
Right. That's right, indeed. Nobody has raised, and I will, voluntary agreements. I think I've mentioned to most of you that was a good discussion that Representative Bueller particularly brought to the table when we were having our discussion this session. And not that requiring them would be, I think, would not necessarily be the proposal, but whether there are sort of good models of those, and perhaps Secretary of State's office or somewhere else could be, you know, templates or the offer to help people finding ways to negotiate them should parties be interested in that. So exploration. I think folks have a vague understanding of a big Senate race in Massachusetts where that was part of the thing. People are telling me, and I don't know from official sources at this point, but that it's become a little bit of a pattern in primary elections in Massachusetts. So it had some, you know, resonance with people, and it has worked a little bit. So I'm hoping that's just one thing we can dip into. And if there's a lot of reasons not to think about it, we can move along, but we'd like to have it on the list.
Yeah.
Well, probably deadly of me to have left the values question to the end. We'll get philosophical and maybe put each other to sleep, or maybe that's the most lively part. I do think that some have been reflected in the comments that you made, and I think that Aaron will help me kind of tease out a little bit some of the back and forth values that you've already expressed when looking at some of these different ideas. But are there things that maybe haven't come up today that people really want to make sure, you know, we don't, you know, things we want to avoid or at least consider, or really positive values that we want to kind of test our ideas against when we get to that point?
I really heard this outright. I mean, it is actually just more public participation in the whole process as well. Not necessarily more people participating in running for office, but actually maybe participating in our electoral process as well. For me, as a value set, that how do we actually increase our overall participation in the electoral process, and whether or not campaign finance reform is either dampening or there's ways when we talk about this that actually helps increase participation.
Participation good is kind of an assumption built into that.
And I would add to that is making the whole process more democratic with a small d, and, you know, again, being here on behalf of non-affiliated voters, we, in a sense, are a marginalized group in part of that process, and there are over 500,000 non-affiliated voters in Oregon.
I kind of come at it with a value that, you know, in a lot of candidacies, no one or two individuals or organizations should be able to kind of fund an entire candidacy. I think it's, you know, obviously candidates have to ask for money, and there's a lot of logic to that. But in terms of the fact that a smaller and smaller group of organizations and individuals is having a bigger and bigger share in how you run campaigns means that, you know, you could, I think we've seen this past primary or in these past elections, two individuals providing 80-90% of the money it takes to run for office, which I think is kind of a very concerning element. So kind of adding that small d democracy to who is funding elections can be helpful in terms of spreading out the idea and kind of like engaging more viewpoints in. I mean, if we have to have fundraising, it should be kind of a something that at least is engaging lots of viewpoints and shouldn't be dependent on just a couple individuals. So kind of like really expanding who is able to kind of come to the table.
Add on to that a second. I wrote that down for myself, and you know, encouraging broader community support to campaigns, not just for the participation, but because of what that represents in terms of who that person then is speaking for, you know, has behind them.
I'd like to speak for the values of freedom and anonymity. I resist telling people, no, you can't spend your money the way you want. You can't give it to this campaign. It's their money, right? They should be able to spend it however they want. And on the anonymity side, we all say transparency is wonderful, but sometimes it has bad consequences. Last year, the Mozilla CEO was basically forced to step down from his role because he had given a few years earlier a mere $1,000 to an unpopular ballot measure. So the mob punished his political activity when I think he should have been able to give that anonymously and shouldn't have had to suffer the mob justice as a result.
Thank you. Norman.
Well, I think on the government side, not contributors, but I think we can probably agree that things like transparency, accountability, responsibility, and diversity are all good things that government should have. And so, likewise, the candidates and ballot measures should have those same kind of qualities.
Transparency, accountability, and diversity. Is that what I get?
And responsibility. Yeah.
I will also add, just from our earlier discussion, we're going to need to test against legality, practicality. And those will be tested as well. Rob?
I think in a lot of ways, Oregon's lucky to have a lot of legislatures who are really in this for the right reason and doing the best they can, given the tools they've been handled, you know, they've been handed. And, you know, 99.6% of the legislatures are absolutely voting the way their hearts and their brains tell them to. So from their perspective, I can see when the legislatures say this is largely a perception issue. I believe that. I also believe when I hear from other people say it's more than a perception, it's actually we feel it does affect outcomes. And so I think we got to bridge that somehow. And I'm not saying that it's one or the other, but it's we have to understand where everybody's coming from. And you made mention of this, I think, a little earlier about this could get bogged down in negative conversation. I don't want it to be. I mean, I think that really people at this table are all here because they want to be at this table and they want to make this a better place to do business or to run for election or whatever it happens to be. And I think that if we make recommendations to the legislature eventually at the end of this day, not today, but you know what I mean, that allow our legislatures to create a framework that does work. And if it solves the perception problem, it'll probably solve any problems other folks at this table think there are as well. And I think that's a common goal that we can agree to work on. Ultimately, it's the legislatures that are going to make these decisions about what's going to work and what's not work. And in a way, I think we could, if we chose to, expand a little bit of the scope of this committee, because it is more, in my view, it's more of a somewhat of a holistic problem. It's not just it's not just campaign finance reform. It's also somewhat related to election reform as well. And I know this task force is not about that, and I know that was not done. But we do have a system in this place, and maybe it's because it's where the voters live, but we have a lot of blue and red districts, and there's not very many competitive districts. And so what happens is you have a few number of competitive districts where all the money ends up gathering. And in my Senate district race, which was Senator Starr and Chuck Riley, they did spend over $1 million each.
Almost two.
Well, each.
Total.
Yeah.
I think Senator Starr may have been just a tick under, but it was a wash pretty much. I mean, I think they must have contacted me 100 times each, and good for them, I guess. So, and you have a few other races around, I think, like that. But as we get fewer and fewer of those swing races, the money that's in there does not seem to be decreasing. So you're going to have more and more money spent. I don't think the candidates, want to be phoning for dollars. I think they would prefer to get small donations from 100 people they talk to, but sometimes it's necessary to get the $10,000 donation from an employer in your district or an out-of-state person, I suppose, even. So I think that everyone should keep in mind that, and I've heard everyone say that really what we want to do is get people back into the system and get more people involved and keep them informed and give them freedom to make these choices. I think no one disagrees with a lot of this. And let's go ahead and get some ideas in place to hand to our legislatures. I think that they can do the right thing and do a good job, I should say. It may not be what I think is right, but it'll probably be a good job, maybe better than what I think. But I think if we make this some ideas, give it to the legislature, think a little more holistically, present it in a way that they can do their jobs in a way that they deem most appropriate.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Can I add on to that? Sure. Thank you for bringing that up. And one of my issues that I was hoping, not necessarily today, we'd talk about is, would it be appropriate for this group to talk about things like redistricting reform? Since we have a platform to make a recommendation to the Rules Committee, it doesn't mean they're going to take it up. I personally think that we need nonpartisan, separate from the parties and candidates, a group to do redistricting in Oregon. I know that's not a popular idea with the parties, so apologies to Trent and others. A couple values that I wanted to call out.
I think we need to have Oregon values, which means that we need to tailor whatever we might recommend to the Rules Committee to actual problems in Oregon, as opposed to national rhetoric around Citizens United or, you know, it's the fact that Oregon is pretty unique in its election money. And we just need to have the facts in front of us before we recommend something that might get at more of a national issue than an Oregon issue. I'm not saying Citizens United is a good thing, but whatever we recommend, I think, ought to have as an end goal to create a level playing field between entities, between parties, whatever it may be, that we not favor a group over another. And the final value is what I brought up earlier, and it's the law of unintended consequences. There are a lot of campaign finance reforms that end up pushing money more into the dark category, which I don't think would be a good outcome for Oregon.
Speak briefly to the issue of connection to other electoral issues. I don't think there's probably anything preventing us from identifying where we think the problems we've been asked to discuss intersect with some of the other things, and whether we have the time or bandwidth to go into detail on what those changes ought to be, but making reference to them and reminding the legislature of those things might. It certainly seems appropriate to me. I don't think anybody will jerk our chain for being out of line with respect to that. I want to make sure, if we do have Representative Gilliam on the phone, that you've had a chance on these issues. Any of them, the problem you spoke to, I think, but values you want to throw out?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would speak quickly to the value of frugality, and I'm so glad that you're the chair. You're the first Secretary of State in the history of Oregon not seeking higher office.
The high office of retired woman is where I'm at.
And I'm also glad the deputy was there. My thought is, in the future, it could be brief, but I would love to hear from staff in the Elections Division who have a lot of experience about the practicality of existing law. Are there things that we could fund in a more efficient way that are working? What are the things in reporting and transparency from their point of view that aren't working? I think they would offer a valuable perspective to us. And then the other issue was the value of education. Whatever this group discusses, whatever the rules committees may or may not do in coming sessions, it will be some time before it has an effect. And I'm concerned about the new generation of Oregonians, not old enough yet to vote, and how we are going, I don't know if this is an appropriate role for government, but how are we going to educate them, not in the old civics textbook way, but how should they watch a political commercial? How should they get involved and look more deeply into finance as we encourage them to be voters, to be candidates, and so forth? Maybe it's the encouragement from the state to educators. Maybe it's the encouragement from the state to nonprofits and partnering with them. But better education of young people who are, you know, they've got their iPhones on 24/7. How do we communicate some of this transparency and involvement in elections to that next generation? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gillum. My son, who was a debater all the way through high school and college, would say, critical thinking. How do we teach them all critical thinking? So appreciate that. Maybe there's an electronic cover to the electronic voters pamphlet that sort of helps people decode the mysterious pack names. Thank you. Very good. Very good. Well, you all have hung in beautifully. I really appreciate that, and I hope it helps us. I think Aaron and I will spend some time together and share with you maybe the massive list, but also maybe a way of kind of organizing some of the thinking around it in talking about some agenda items for the next meeting. We certainly will have a potentially a proposal for how those next meetings will go on a calendar for ourselves. We started working back from that date, but didn't want to, until people had a chance to get together, didn't want to, you know, prescribe here are the things that we need to do. We do have, I think, one piece of the mandate inexplicit in the book, in the statute, but certainly as I said earlier, this came out of a discussion of a constitutional amendment and the question of limits. That's not going to be the only agenda item that we have, but I do think it is one that we want to wrestle with and the legislature wants to hear from us about. So that's going to be in there somewhere, but we're going to try to put it in the kinds of context that you're talking about. And I envision a wonderful report out of the eloquence of this group. So I'm not just sucking up. I think it really was a very good discussion. I hope you feel like it as well. Anybody had anything they wanted to add? We don't have public testimony that wanted to come, but perhaps next time they'll have watched this and thought it was so fabulous that they just have to show up and join in next time, and we'll make some room there. Do you want to go over the schedule? Would that be a good thing, Aaron, or any other recommendations you have?
Task force, just a couple of things that have come up as we've sat here. One, thank you, Mr. Lukow. I found the website. It's very illustrative of the races. It's quite detailed. I will send a link out to you. It breaks down, as I've kind of been sitting here looking at it, it breaks down every House race down to the, smallest contribution. It breaks down every statewide race, courts. It illuminates some of the points that were made anecdotally in terms of the million-dollar races. You can see where the money's coming from. It's quite a detailed website. So to Mr. Delaney's point, we have that information that we will be able to look at. It will reinforce and maybe shine some light on some of the things we talked about today. But I will send that out and that link in a follow-up. You can go and look at any state and do like the gross comparison. So this data is easy to use, easy to look at, so it is out there. One other point, and I will point this out to Dan, regarding court cases and particularly around the judicial question. There's been a court case in Florida that has called into question whether or not it's appropriate to limit contributions in the cases of judges. So that might be something to look at. They are saying that there is maybe a substantial interest there that they should not be campaigning and getting contributions. So I'll make sure that Dan highlights that case for us in the future. Our next meeting, October 1st, it's going to be Thursday. We will always be meeting in this room. We will always be meeting 9 to 1. We will always have the conference call access and materials on Granicus beforehand. But that will be during regular legislative committee days at that point. We will then be meeting in November, again, aligned with legislative days. And then we will also be meeting in December 10th. And we will be, at that point, acting on our initial report to both the rules committees, as that will be our last opportunity to meet before December 31st. Which is our deadline for reporting. It is entirely possible that should momentum be there and we continue to feel the need to meet, there'll be opportunities to meet up to the legislative session and then beyond that, and that we can kind of feel out as we go along.
What was the date for November? Sorry.
November is going to be
19th.
Thursday the 19th.
And could I just ask Aaron a question? So if legislation is recommended in this report, the deadline to request legislative counsel to draft bills for the February session is before the last meeting of this group, right?
It is in the case of the Senate. The House Committee on Rules is not subject to that deadline. So if there is...
there's always an open door
there
somewhere.
And so that's kind of why, if Dan is going to be involved and be drafting along, if you feel like there is drafting to be done in advance, and being also because the House rules does not have a limit on the number of bills, and the Senate rules is subject to, I didn't want to presume that would be how we would use our two bills. Mm-hmm. So we have some flexibility in that issue there in terms of going into February session if we have a concept to go forward at that point. So we have some latitude there.
So it's all on you, Rep. Rayfield.
I hearken back, having been in the Speaker's office at the time, and the very first discussions of actual limitations on the number of bills that one could introduce.
That's true, I remember
that.
Oh
my gosh, was that a painful, painful discussion, and hope you all are living through it fine. I left the building soon after getting that established. So.
I would say, Senator, this is another reason you should never have left us in the House.
I was wondering, and this is a little bit out of order there, I mean, for the committee rules, I was wondering if we could somehow put an additional committee rule to limit Representative Gilliam's breathing
over the phone. I'm going to leave that personal between the two of you. Or not. He's going to be in the room next time, and he can take all the breaths.
Actually, I won't be in the room, so I can breathe heavily over the phone in his stead.
I'll let you two work through that. So, thank you very much for go
process
ahead.
Process question: what do you anticipate the final report process will be? Is it going to be something we vote on? Majority rules? How is there going to be a minority report if folks disagree? What do you anticipate?
Karen and I discussed that, and I asked about sort of the patterns that other task forces have been, and there have been a variety of ways that disagreement has been reflected in reports. So.
And I have, and I shared with the chair, I've seen a number of things depending on how strong the opposition is. We've had task forces do reports and have and include within that report a minority report of the members. Particularly, I think to the Bottleville task force, there was a minority report included at the will of the task force. That this is where all the points, the majority certainly agrees here, but these are all the points of disagreement. We have had cases in which a minority of the members disagree with particular pointed aspects of introduced legislation. They didn't want to offer a minority report per se, but they did want their objections noted. That is really up to us how we craft that report, depending on where if and where the disagreements arise. There is 100% opportunity to include minority reports or alternatives of a minority group of this task force in a final report to the legislature.
And just to add my own values into that, obviously, I think it's important if we're going to put forward ideas that are going to be successful, that we have as much agreement as we can, not expecting it's ever going to be 100% in that regard, but that it's also important as an educational tool that the legislative leadership and legislators understand from this report where the challenges are, and maybe not by name who, but you know, sort of categories of folks, because they're going to be the ones, if there's going to be something happen, they're going to have to build the coalition, you know, or work with the coalition to make it happen, and the clearer we are about this really sticks in my craw, you know, or my community is, you know, going to react negatively to this, it's important that we have that honestly reflected for them.
Another process question. Who's responsible for organizing and actually drafting the report?
Well, staff will do a lot of that, that writing and drafting. I think she'll work very closely with me. We will hopefully, you know, get versions out for comment and reaction as much as possible. But a lot falls on staff here. There's no question about it. Thank you all.
Thank you. I
appreciate it. Thanks. Oh, we're adjourned. So unused to having the guy. Thank you.
What you been up to? What you been up to?
Having the guy.
Thank you.